The good news spilled from the journalist's lips, a secret he could not wait to share. Yet Catherine was so ill, she showed little emotion at her victory and did not smile. Tom would later confide that she cries but rarely smiles. She has forgotten how to laugh. It could have been that she did not quite believe it. She half rose in bed in an effort to look at the compensation decision which was written out for her, but she did not have the strength to do so fully. She sank back against the pillows, and as the news, too, sank in, her primary thought was for Tom. Her first words, wrote the eager journalist, formed a wish that her husband Thomas would quickly hear of the decision. "I am glad for the sake of my children and my husband," Catherine whispered. "The lump sums will help Tom, who has been out of work for many months." As though remembering, she then said with a weak smile to the reporter, "This is the second good news we had in a week. My husband just got back on the payroll at the glass factory." Some workers had been recalled to Libby Owens, and Tom had managed to get on the night shift. As the reporter lingered in the room, hoping for more copy, Catherine spoke on. "The judge is grand," she commented. "He's so wonderful. He's very fair. That means a lot." As though the idea of fairness had triggered something in her, an anger blazed within her for a brief moment. "It should have been done a long time ago," she said, almost bitterly. "I've been suffering. I'll have to suffer more. I wonder if I will live to receive any of the money. I hope so, but I am afraid it will come too late." Yet Catherine had not put her life at risk for herself. She had done it for her family and friends. "Now maybe Tom and our two children can really live again," she said in hope. "I may not live to enjoy the money myself, but I hope it will come in time for the other girls. I hope they get it before their conditions become as bad as mine." She added one final comment, a croaked whisper that fell flat in the oddly quiet, stale-aired room, which held none of the jubilation of the courtroom in Chicago. "I hope the lawyers don't upset it," Catherine Donahue said. Chapter 55. 2 weeks after the judgment, Radium Dial filed an appeal against the verdict, upon contention the award was contrary to the evidence. Having anticipated such a move, Grossman and the Society of the Living Dead instantly staged a media photo call and launched an appeal for immediate funds for Catherine. "She has no money, no prospects of getting any through her own efforts and mounting doctor's bills," declared Charlotte Purcell. "I fear Mrs. Donahue will die before her case is adjudicated." Catherine was touched by her friend's support, but her overwhelming concern was for Tom. He had taken the news of the appeal hard. "He doesn't say much," Catherine confided to Pearl, "but it has been such a strain on him." The women continued to enlist the help of the media in their campaign for justice. The Donahues invited the Toronto Star into their home for an interview. "The eggshell woman in the bed may be dying," wrote Star journalist Frederick Griffin, "but she is fighting." They were all fighting, the women and their supporters too. As Griffin visited 520 East Superior Street one quiet April evening, he met all the Dial painters who had filed suit, as well as the men standing behind them, Inez's father, George, Tom, Al, Clarence and Hobart. This senseless tragedy had affected them as well as their wives and daughters. "They're scared," Clarence Witt said of the women, as his wife readied Catherine in the other room. Every little ache or pain scares them.